morning, guys. I already, I guess, had a very good introduction. So, in case you're wondering, all of this is up here now. But also, I had the privilege this month to be in the ASEM monthly. So if you guys ever pick up one of these, I actually have my testimony in here, as well as reason for why I became a psychotherapist. So you could find my testimony in here if you guys want to. It's written in Chinese. Most of you guys can probably read that. So I'm just going to start out with an agenda. I'm going to talk a little bit about what it means to have a good relationship with your teen, what's going on with your teen in terms of developmentally, socially, that kind of stuff. I'm going to talk a little bit about attachment theory because that's a really important theory when it comes to understanding why your kids turned out the way that they are. And I'm going to talk a little bit about family dynamics and how that influences your relationship with your teen, as well as cultural differences. As we know that especially most of our kids here are second generation or even third generation Chinese, and you can really have a lot of cultural clashes that cause breakdown in your relationship. So what does it mean to have a good relationship with your teen? Does anybody have any ideas about what that means? You can just shout it out or put up your hand.
Good communication.
Yeah, you can talk to each other.
Respect each other.
Pardon?
Support.
Support each other, yep. Anything else? They want to stay with you. Okay. Yeah, that's a harder one, but they could be. So a good relationship is simple. It's everything that you guys mentioned. It means that there is mutual trust and respect. So what that means is you trust each other, right? You're able to talk to each other, share your secrets, share your hurts and your joys with one another, and you're not going to be expecting that you'll be attacked, right? Or that the words that you say are gonna hurt each other, right? So it does not mean that we don't fight or have conflict. I think a lot of people have this conception that to have a good relationship means you never fight or you never butt heads, but that's not true. Having fights or having conflict is actually a healthy part of relationships, so long as you deal with them in a healthy way. It means that there is emotional and physical safety. So physical safety we understand, right? You don't hit each other, right? But how about emotional safety? What does it mean to have emotional safety? It means that when we share our feelings with one another, or when we are sad, mad, we can express it to one another without facing any backlash, without facing any negative criticism. I can come to my mom and cry, and she's not going to be like, "Stop crying. Why are you crying? Why are you being such a wimp?" or something, right? It does not mean that your child will listen to everything you say, nor will they tell you everything. There needs to be good boundaries involved in a good relationship. So if you're telling everything to your child or your parents, it means you don't have good emotional boundaries, and you need boundaries in order to build that relationship. But it also means that they won't necessarily listen to everything that you say. So just because you say, "Hey, I'm hurt," your kid might not listen, and they might not understand, and that's okay too. Good relationships also mean that you spend quality time together. So quality time isn't you're on your phone and I'm on my phone and we sit together. That's not quality time, right? Quality time means having dinner together often. Quality time means going on family vacations together. It means that there are times where you are interacting with your child, and it's not just, we're doing things together, but there's interaction involved in that quality time. But that doesn't mean that your child would always want to spend time with you. I mean, as your children grow up, they're going to want to move out, they're going to want to do their own thing, and maybe you're like, hey, come grocery shopping with me, and they're like, nah. And you might feel hurt because maybe he always came grocery shopping with you, and he was always your bag boy, but all of a sudden, he doesn't want to do it anymore. But that doesn't mean that there's a relationship breakdown, right? Good relationships mean that parents and teens feel connected to one another. So it means that you and I can talk to one another, and you'll understand each other, and you'll feel like there's a relationship there, there's a connection there, a bond there, right? But it doesn't mean that you and your child are going to be best friends. I think a lot of parents might want to be best friends with their children, but that's actually very unhealthy because you're a parent. You're not a friend, you're not a peer, you're a parent. And parenting means that there are certain responsibilities that come with it, like discipline that friends don't do with one another, right? So don't expect that you guys are going to always want to hang out and always going to have fun together. It's not going to be the case, right? So what's going on with my teen? I think a lot of parents need to understand what's going on when we say that your child is going through adolescence. They're in their teenage stage. There's a lot of changes that happen. So I'm going to talk about developmental changes, first of all. Physical changes. So we all know that puberty occurs. That means that they're going to have more hair in certain places, and they're going to grow taller. Their voices will change, and there's going to be a lot of hormones. These physical changes can cause self-esteem issues in both boys and girls. And so we have to be very aware of these physical changes as they're happening. Are we making them feel uncomfortable about when we point them out? Perhaps your son's voice might crack when he speaks. Are you laughing at him? Or are you understanding of that? Intellectually, the frontal lobe of your brain is still developing. So in teenagers, as they're growing older, you're going to start to notice that the way they think might be a little bit different because their frontal lobe is developing. And it doesn't finish developing until like the young adulthood. So even though they might look like an adult or act like an adult, they're not adults. And we have to remember that when we're speaking to them and reasoning with them, that they're not adults. They can't necessarily comprehend or understand the things that we are telling them. So their frontal lobe is responsible for judgment, impulse control, and planning. So you might notice that your teen might be really impulsive, right? They might go, oh, I really want that. I'm going to go buy that, right? That's because their frontal lobe hasn't developed properly. It's not because they're irresponsible with their money or something like that. We often attach meaning to their behavior when there shouldn't be those meanings, when we should really be looking at the developmental issue. Another thing is that children often at this stage are they do lots of risk-taking behaviors. So they might want to, skateboard, and they might want to do a lot of really cool tricks on it, and they don't think that they're going to get hurt, right? And part of it is because their judgment isn't that good yet, right? And we can't judge them for that. Their thinking starts to become more concrete as well. They might be able to solidify more ideas, like understand more like black and white kind of arguments. They're also more egocentric, so they think about themselves more. and they're present focused. So they think a lot about currently what's going on. So when you talk to them about, like, especially like when they're in 7th, 8th grade, when you talk about university, they can't think that far. Like, it's irrational for us to think that they're going to plan for, like, the next 10 years of their life at this time, because they really can't think that far. Their focus is what's going on now, how am I going to go through, go to school tomorrow when I have to deal with these issues or whatever, right? They can't think about, oh, 10 years down the line, I might have to invest in, like, you know, whatever stock. No. But later on, as they start to develop maybe into high school and then college, you'll notice that their thinking will become more abstract. So they're going to be able to think more philosophically. Things like, what's the meaning of life? Maybe they might not think about that, but they're going to be able to think about different scenarios, different possibilities. They're not as black and white. And higher order thinking is going to come into play. And they're going to have greater self-awareness. And that greater self-awareness also includes awareness of other people. So as they're growing up, when they're maybe 14, 15, they're very egocentric. They think only about themselves, how they fit into the world. But as they grow older into later adolescence, they're going to think, okay, how do I interact with the world now? What are my roles in the rest of the world? You'll also notice emotional changes, so changes in the brain chemistry, mostly neurotransmitters, and those neurotransmitters can cause your child to be more emotional, and it can make them have a harder time handling stress. So you might notice that your kid might be very reactive now when you talk to them, and you're like, hey, can you take out the garbage? And they're like, oh my gosh, I always have to take out the garbage. Right? And you're like, whoa, I just asked you for a simple favor. Well, part of it is that, you know, the brain chemistry, and they're not able to regulate their emotions yet, right? So why am I telling you these kind of things? Well, part of it is that you need to understand that these things are happening, and it's not their fault. It's not their fault that they're saying, like, or they're being upset at throwing out the garbage. It's not their fault that they're, you know, falling a million times on their skateboard and they're still getting back on it, right? And we have to be aware that these changes are temporary, and it doesn't. That's not who they are always going to be, right? And lastly, there's the social part, and the social part is probably the hardest part for a lot of parents. This is the area of identity formation. So they're trying to figure out who they are, and they're trying to figure out who they are apart from your parents, apart from my family. And what's going to happen is their peer groups are going to be more important, so their relationships with their friends are going to be more important, and they're not going to listen to you as much. They're going to take on more of the values of their peer groups. And that can be very scary for a lot of us. I say us as if I had children, but I actually don't. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about this identity development, because that is going to be integral to how you relate to your child, how you build your relationship with your child. So adolescence is a period of identity formation, and it's both social and personal. What that means is that at this point in their life, they're trying to figure out who they are, what they want to be, what their personality is. They might try different personalities. Maybe one day they're like dressed in all black and they're all emo, and then maybe the next day they're like wearing all these colorful clothing and they're trying to be a hippie. I don't know. I don't know what the kids are into these days. But at this point, a lot of the influences are going to come from media. A lot of the influences are going to come from their peer groups. And I think it's important, I know it sounds scary, but it's important for them to explore and test limits and be autonomous so that they can figure out which identity fits them. So One way you can help them is to throw them into different things. Let them play hockey. Let them, you know, play piano. If they, at this point, they're like, hey, mom, I really want to try out CrossFit. And you're like, oh, you're just developing. I don't know. But why not, right? Because these are healthy things, too. I mean, now if they're, like, exploring things like drugs and alcohol, absolutely, as a parent, these are limits that you can put down. But allow them to have their own say and their own understanding of what is okay and what is not, because it'll really shape them, right? When they figure out that, hey, this identity is no good for me, it's better than if you told them, hey, don't do this. Because if you tell them don't do this, they're more inclined to want to do it. So big questions are, who am I? Who do I want to be? I talked about that. Some will adapt the values of their parents, and then some will also adapt the identity and values of their peer group. So it is actually very important then, as parents, to encourage them to go to peers that you approve of. Like, for example, fellowship, friends who study, or whatever it is that you feel like is important. But at the same time, be very careful about not choosing their friends for them. I mean, a lot of parents will say, oh, why don't you hang out with Johnny? He's a nice boy. And your kid's like, well, I don't actually, like, he has nothing in common with me, right? And so that idea of autonomy is going to be very important. Let them choose. And when they choose and you like it, encourage them. So say things like, oh, I really like that friend of yours that you brought over. He seems like a very smart boy. And then allow that conversation to happen. Allow your child to tell you about their friends. And then identity the achievement will help them with better self-esteem. So unfortunately, what we've noticed in research is that their parents who hover too much, parents who control too much, actually stifles their child's identity development. And what happens then is that they end up developing lower self-esteem. So when I say stifle, I mean, like, you know, the parents are very controlling about who they hang out with, what they do, all of their social activities, all of their, I guess, hobbies. And so this child never develops an identity of their own. This identity has been given to them by the parents. And at that point, they don't know who they are. They haven't figured that out because they were never allowed room to. So when they become adults, they don't know who they are. And their self-esteem often dips because of that. In terms of identity development, another thing is that teens are very egocentric. So they think a lot about themselves. You might hear them say things like, Mom, you'll never understand. So why should I tell you anyways? You know, nobody understands me. They'll talk about, like, them as the way that they are, as if, like, they're the only person experiencing this, right? It's because they're very self-centered. They can't see outside of themselves. They can't see that there's other people and other experiences out there. They know it because they've heard about it, but they can't put themselves in that position to understand it. So they might experience self-conscious desires to feel important in peer groups, and they might want to receive social acceptance. You'll see this on social media now. So things like Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, they're always doing these things. You know, you might see that they're always posting photos of themselves and that kind of stuff, because they want to receive social acceptance. They want to feel important. The number of likes that they get on their photos and stuff like that validate them. Now, that's problematic, because if they're not getting that validation from the social networks, what's going to happen to their self-esteem at this point? It can make them feel very low, right? So as a parent, in terms of building a relationship with your child, it is extremely important for you to validate and mirror their personality or identity back to them, for you to be where they get their acceptance from. So perhaps, for example, they're really into the sport that they play, and maybe they're a great soccer player, right? And maybe that's something you can affirm them in and say, hey, you're getting really good at this, right? And that will help solidify their identity as a soccer player. The egocentrism also results in teens to think more about themselves and to develop their concept of self. So it's really a good thing at this point. It allows them to reflect on themselves. And so for you as parents, one of the things that you can do is ask self-reflective questions. What do you think of that? How do you feel about so-and-so doing this? What are your values around this one thing? Right. Rather than imparting your values, imparting your identity on them by telling them, you should think like this. You should really read your Bible more. You should really be more Christ-centered. That's not helpful to them, right? Because a lot of children, as they're trying to develop an identity outside of their parents, might choose to rebel from their parents just because they want to differentiate. And so rather than giving them ideas of who they should be, explore it with them by asking these kind of good questions. So effects on parental relationships. The developmental aspects of it can really put a lot of pressure on parents. So as they're trying to form their identity, you'll notice that they're pulling away and they're not listening to you as much. They want to hang out with their friends more. And this can really cause a rift, right? Because you're starting to think, oh, my little boy doesn't want to hang out with me anymore. My little girl is starting to develop all of these relationships outside of the ones that she had when she was younger, and I'm worried, right? But parents still play a significant role in identity formation. And warm and healthy parenting, our parent-child relationship can be associated with positive child outcomes. So what I mean by warm and healthy is you're not criticizing them. Instead, you're giving them space to speak to you, and you're kind to them when you speak. You're not like, why are you so stupid? I mean, like, sometimes it's like, I hear this in my head when my mom's like, they become chonya, you know, and I'm just like, okay, that's not helpful, right? So it's important to be warm to your child, even if you think you're joking with them. They internalize these things, right? When a solid and positive relationship exists, adolescents are more likely to feel freedom in exploring identity options. So you want them to feel free to explore these identity options so that they can figure out who they are and establish a good self-concept and good self-esteem later on, right? But if you don't give them that space, if your relationship with them is rocky, they're not going to be able to feel that way. They might feel anxious about even venturing out. One thing with Asian parenting that I find is it's very, very strict, right? And not necessarily warm, but it's very strict. And children want to please their parents very easily. And so their identity becomes very much, how do I please my parents? Getting straight A's, doing well in school kind of thing. When relationships are not as close or supportive, adolescents fear rejection from parents, and they're more likely to feel less confident in forming a separate personal identity. So, yeah, basically, adolescents will fear that parents won't like them or will criticize them if they, you know, take up this one identity. Maybe arts. I mean, a lot of Asian families don't like their children going into arts. It's a stereotype, of course, But if your kid said, hey, I want to pursue music as a career, how do you deal with that? I know that for a lot of us, we worry, oh, what if they don't make money in this field? I don't know. This isn't a good idea, right? But how do you say that to your kid in a warm way, right? One thing is perhaps exploring it with them rather than telling them, no, that's not a good idea. I think you should drop this dream. Maybe go, oh, okay, let's think about this for a second. Let's put this on the table. What would you do? How do you think you're going to make this work? But support them in exploring that option, even if you don't approve. And let them know, hey, I don't know if it's a good idea, but if that's what you want, we can explore it. You're also likely to see more conflict, especially in areas of control. This is going to be the big area where you fight about curfews, when to go to bed, when to put your cell phone away, when to eat, what they're wearing, right to privacy, so like cell phone use kind of thing, closing your door and locking them. I know a lot of families don't allow their kids to lock the door for good reason, right? But they're going to fight with you over that because they want to have a separate identity now. They want to separate from you. They want to become someone who is independent and an adult. Again, they aren't adults yet, so you do have rights as a parent to enforce these things. But what giving them autonomy means is discussing with them. Okay, you want to go to bed at midnight? I think you really should go to bed at 10 o'clock. Let's compromise. 10:30. Okay. And working that out with your kid. Sometimes it's also about letting them fail, right? Sure, go to bed at midnight. See what time you're going to wake up tomorrow and how tired you're going to be. I know that sounds kind of like counterproductive, but eventually letting them fail will let them know that, hey, like, number one, you trusted them in their decision. Number two, they failed in that. And number three, hey, perhaps my parents are right. So how to facilitate my teen and their development? We talked a little bit about it as I was going. Number one thing is to accept that changes are occurring and that your relationship with your teen will change as they grow older. So you can't expect that your baby boy is always going to be your baby boy, that he's always going to want to go grocery shopping with you, that he's always going to be neat and, you know, make the bed every morning. That's probably not going to happen. And you have to accept that they're going to have friends that you might disapprove of. They're going to have experiences that you might disapprove of. One good way to help with that is validating their experience. And what I mean by validating is letting them know that their experiences are normal and it's okay to feel the way that they do. So maybe perhaps they're angry with you for enforcing a curfew. Let them know, hey, you know what? I know this really sucks. It sucks to go to bed early. And let them know that you understand that they don't want to do it. But gently tell them why. Right? Rather than just say, no, you have to go to bed at 10:30. It's my way or the highway. That can be very cold. Right? It can make them feel like you don't understand them. And come on. We all went through teenage years. I know for some of us it might be really far away, and then for some of us it's a little bit closer, but we all went through that, and we know what it's like to want to have our own lives, right? So you can share with them your experiences and share with them that you understand that they want to be independent. And another thing is act as a mirror that reflects back their character that they are building for themselves. So I talked a little bit about this earlier, but it's this idea that you don't want to impress your image of what you want on them. Rather, you want to reflect back what they're showing you about themselves. So it could be the bad parts and the good parts. So if they're like, you know, I want to be a good person and be and help animals, you could be like, hey, that's really cool. You have a really kind heart. Right? That's a reflection of what you see in them. And if they're being jerks, then that's something you want to reflect back to. Hey, right now your tone is not very nice. And I know that you're a nice person, but this doesn't align with who I thought a nice person would be. Right? So reflecting that back so that they can see for themselves what kind of character they're displaying to you. Allow your child independence and autonomy to explore their identity. So don't criticize. Don't tell them their pants are too low or you don't like the fade on their jeans or whatever. But have a discussion with them about what they think. Oh, why do you like to wear your pants that low? Perhaps that will help them think maybe that their pants are too low and they're kind of ridiculous. This also means that we allow them room to fail and bear the consequences of that behavior. So what I mean by that is sometimes behaviors will lead to negative consequences. If your child is going to go out and graffiti someone's car, then they might need to be arrested. And I know as parents, we don't want that to happen. Right? We want to protect them from it. But these are the consequences of doing these kinds of things, that they might get in trouble. Of course, we want to help them through that process. And I'm just thinking back to my own experience. My brother was in trouble with the law when he was younger. And my dad sat us down and he said, you know, I expect this from you. And I was like, whoa, that's really different. I thought he would yell at me. And he said, but here's the reasons why I don't want you doing these things. But now you're in trouble. Let's figure out what the next steps are. Right. It's a warm, very supportive way of allowing your child to bear the consequences rather than shielding them from the reality of life. And the last thing is encourage them to participate in family decision making. This helps build autonomy, this sense of, hey, you trust me as an independent being, as a grown-up. Maybe ask them, hey, where do you want to go for dinner tonight? Ooh, mom's birthday is coming up. Let's plan something for her. Okay. These processes can help them build into your relationship with each other as a family, giving them an active part to play in the family. And that really helps to solidify that connection you have with one another as well. And lastly, I do want to say that it is extremely important to work out your own insecurities as a parent. So what I mean by that is I think a lot of us bring into the relationship with your children your own insecurities, your own fears, your own anxieties. I know if I was ever a parent, I'd be very, very scared that they'd go down the same path that I would, which wasn't very good. If you read my testimony, you'll see. But I would be very afraid of that, and I might do things that I think would protect them, but it might harm them more. For example, I might be very anxious about who they're going out with all the time, right? And questioning them all the time because of my own anxiety. So if that's the case, maybe it's something that we have to work out within ourselves. What are we insecure about? Why are we insecure about these things? Is it reasonable? Are we projecting our own insecurities onto our children? Are we thinking the worst of our kids? Right? Because when we do that, we are being very presumptuous. We're already assuming that our kids are going to go down the bad path, when we haven't even put the trust in our child that, hey, perhaps they will choose rightly. So I'm going to talk about attachment theory. That's going to be a lot more theory. So it might be a little bit boring. But attachment theory is very important to the development of a child. It's about how your child grows up and how they respond and attach to the caregiver being mom and dad mostly, right? And how that shapes your behavior in your relationship later on. So there's four big elements of attachment theory. The first one is proximity maintenance. And this is the child's desire to be around the people they're attached to. We all want to be near or around the people we know and have bonds with. And this need is heightened in children. Your child's always going to reach for you, right? Think about, like, you know, your two-year-old child always coming to you and reaching for you, right? They should want that. The safe haven is basically a safe house for children's attachment. When confronted with danger, they desire to return back to the safe house. So when we think about maybe as we're growing up and maybe we're having a hard time, is it safe for me to come home? Is it safe for me to rely on my family, right? A secure base allows a child to explore the world around them. So think about a child going out into the playground, and they're walking away, and then they turn around and they're like, "Oh, is mom still there? Okay," and then they run back out, right? That you create that safe base for them, so that they know that if they walk away, everything is still going to be okay when they come back, and you're not going to abandon them, right? And then there's separation distress, anxiety from being away from the caregiver. We know when our children are young, there's separation anxiety. When mom goes to work, sometimes baby cries, right? That's normal. That should happen, right? So these are four basic elements of attachment theory. So let's talk firstly about secure attachment, because that's what we want for all of our children. Now, unfortunately, not all of us get there. So secure attachment results from a good relationship with a child, and they are confident that their needs will be met with the appropriate response. So, for example, when a baby cries and they're hungry, the expectation is that they're going to get food. If a baby falls and hurts themselves, the expectation is that mom's going to come and brush them off and kiss them better, right? That's what I mean by having their needs met. Children with secure attachments are confident from separating from their caregiver and exploring the world, knowing that the caregiver is a reliable, secure base. So they know that if they run away and play on the playground, when they come back, mom's still going to be here. They can be confident that they will have comfort in times of distress, knowing that the caregiver is a good, safe haven. So when things aren't going well, they know that they can come back to you. And this results in a long and trusting relationship, good self-esteem and self-image. So how does this manifest in adults? So when kids are young, for example, you provide them with their needs whenever they need it. They feel confident about going and playing on the playground and that you're going to be there. They know that they can run back to you, that you're safe. If they're crying, that they can run back to you. As adults, it's going to be the same thing. They know that, hey, if they went into any problems, for example, if they broke up with their boyfriend, they can come home to you and that you will comfort them. They know that if they need money and they're off at university, that they can go, "Mom, I'm really in a tough situation right now. Could you help me out?" Okay. So that's what a safe base is. And it allows them to have good relationships later on, because they're not anxious about, oh, is this person going to support me later on? Is this person going to provide me with needs? And as I go through the other attachment styles, you're going to start to notice what a secure attachment really is comparatively. The next one is the ambivalent and anxious attachment. So what happens is this attachment style leads to insecurity and clinging behavior. So it comes from caregivers who are inconsistent with the level of care and attention. So this is, when I talk about these other attachment styles, I don't want you guys to think that anybody deliberately does this. Now, there are people who deliberately do these things, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, like, you know, even circumstances that allow something like this to happen. So, for example, if mom is the only caregiver at home, and you've got four other siblings that to take care of, maybe the level of attention and care that mom can give this child is not enough because there's just too much going on. So one minute the caregiver is attentive to the child's needs, the next they're ignored. So, you know, sometimes when your child cries, you can run to them, but other times you can't because you're busy with something else, right? And this can cause a child to be sucked into and crave the attention of the caregiver. So they're always clingy. They always want attention from you. They always want to know that you're there. It can cause a child to consistently want to seek that attention. So people who are very attention-seeking probably have this kind of attachment. And they don't feel like they have a reliable, safe, and secure base. And they don't want to separate from the caregiver. So these are people that end up being very, very clingy. Now think about dating relationships. Maybe one person ends up being very emotionally attached all the time and want to know where their spouse is all the time and want to know that they are loved. Do you love me? Do you love me? You know, like that kind of behavior. And that comes from this kind of anxious attachment style. They don't feel secure about their relationship that they have with their caregiver or significant other. And as adults, they struggle to have a strong, lasting relationship. And they fear that their partner does not love them. They're easily distressed. They may always seek approval. And it makes them hard to be alone. In parents, I see, or in parent-child relationships, I see this manifesting as children who might want... Who might always want their parents' approval. One second, the mom might be like, oh, yo, that's a nice painting. And then another second, it's like, okay, don't bother me right now. Right? So, like, it leads to this inconsistent attention, inconsistent care, and the child never knows when they're going to get care, when they're going to get attention. So any attention they have, they hold on to it. Right? The next is the avoidant attachment style. I'm going to be very transparent with you. This is my attachment style right here. So due to caregivers who are neglecting and insensitive to the child's needs. Now, I don't want you to think my parents neglected me. That's not what happened. This can result from life just happening. For example, my parents were working immigrant parents. They had to work two jobs and never were home. Right? So that, in a sense, is they're neglecting my needs, right? But did they want that to happen? No. Okay. So children might not show signs of connecting in emotional or physical ways. So they might not want to tell you things that are going on. They might not want to give you hugs. Caregiver neglects the child who learns not to seek attention as they will not be responded to. So the child ends up growing, I'm not even going to bother mom because I'm not going to get any attention. Children might look mature and independent. They don't seek reassurance from others and they're comfortable on their own. So they don't need the approval of other people. And it's not because they've grown up to not care about what other people think. It's that other people don't think anything anyway, so I'm not going to care, right? They lack that safe haven, and so they won't seek comfort, and they won't, and they will avoid trying to get that comfort. They might not cuddle. If they get hurt themselves, maybe when they fall down, they're like, you know, they're crying, and then you're like, hey, are you okay? And they're like, no, I'm fine. Right? And they don't believe that they have a reliable, safe base, and they see little difference between a stranger and a caregiver. And as in adults, they will struggle with intimacy and they will actively avoid it, unwilling to share their thoughts and feelings, and will not accept praise, which they might interpret as patronizing. So you might find that there are children or teenagers who just don't want to tell you anything, who just avoid all kinds of intimacy, and they don't even want to accept that when you say, hey, good job, they're like, oh yeah, okay, sure, right? And it could possibly be that they had an avoidant attachment type. And like I said, nobody did this to their child purposely. It just resulted from life circumstances. So don't blame yourself. And the last one is disorganized, and this results in a child experiencing frightening and distressing behaviors. So this one is more if you were abusive to your child, then this is the one that they might display. They might exhibit both ambivalent and avoidant types of attachment styles, and there's no safe haven, no secure base for them to go back to, and they may lose the ability to empathize. They might feel misunderstood and not accepted and alone. So this one is the one where most likely there was abuse in the, not just the family. It might not even be the family. Maybe abuse from someone that they trusted. Maybe an uncle or a nanny even, right? So this can happen if that's the case. So the thing with attachment styles is that it actually occurs very early on in life, so when they're children, like children. And so we might feel like, well, what can we do about it now? And the truth is, there is going to be a lot of attachment styles that aren't going to change, but we can help fix that problem as they're growing into adolescence, because this is a time where their brains are changing and they're able to rationalize, able to think outside of themselves as they get older. And it can be a good time to start perhaps fixing those attachment styles that were negative. So we can do that by giving our child that secure base and that safe haven. So letting them know, hey, you can come to me. Like, I'm sorry, in the past, perhaps I wasn't very understanding when you told me that you were depressed, but I understand now. And I want you to come to me now if anything happens, right? So changing that that secure base, allowing them to be able to come to you, letting them know it's okay to feel the things that they feel so that they can come to you, that they feel safe when they come to you. So you do this by opening up space to be empathetic when the child speaks, and you try to understand their viewpoint. So when I say empathetic, it means that you want to be able to step into your child's shoes and understand it from their point of view. And we want to avoid judgments or advice and just listen. So rather than going, that was such a stupid decision, you should do blah, 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 blah. They already know they probably made a stupid decision. And they're coming to you not to hear these things. They're coming to you for you to encourage them and support them and guide them. So listen to them instead. What happened? Tell me what happened. What can I do to support you? And again, give them room to fail. Right? Having a safe haven means that if I fail, I know I can go back to my safe haven and things will be all right. For people who don't have the safe haven, don't have the secure base, failing is not an option. Because if I fail, I have nowhere to go. There will be no support. Right? But if they have that in you, and you can provide them with that safe haven, they can fail and they can come back to you. And reinforce secure relationships. Oh, sorry. Missed one. Encourage them to test out new ideas and build up their confidence. So encourage them to explore the world, just as they did when they were young, when they were kids, and you're like, hey, go play on that slide. Encourage them to go and explore different career options, different hobbies, that kind of stuff, so that it will build up their confidence. When you encourage them to do that, they feel safer. They feel like, hey, I can come to you when things don't go right, or if I don't like it, I can come back and say, Mom, I didn't like that, right? And then you won't criticize them and go, but I spent that so much money on it, right? The next thing is family dynamics. So I'm going to talk about systems theory. It's the theory that I work off of as a psychotherapist with a lot of families. So this idea is that families exist in a system. So individuals are not independent of one another. Everyone affects and feeds off of each other. And they're emotionally interdependent with one another. So that means that when I'm sad, my mom's going to be feeling it in some way or another. When I'm stressed, the family is going to respond, right? Every person within that system has a role to play, and there are rules that exist, spoken or unspoken, and that's how the family runs. For example, when dinner time happens, a lot of times everybody knows who's going to scoop the rice, who's going to set up the table, who's going to, you know, do all these things. These are rules that have been established by your family, right? But it's also about emotional rules and boundaries. Is it okay to talk about my feelings? Was that ever established in your family, right? And if you notice that nobody talks about their feelings, then maybe unconsciously you'll realize that, oh, that's a rule in my family. We don't talk about feelings. And everybody has a role to play, right? So for example, we might have a child that is the loud child. He's always the loud child, right? And then we have another child who's the comic. He's the funny child. These are roles that you have given your family members. Unconsciously, of course. You didn't go, okay, now you're going to be the loud one, now you're going to be the funny one. But these are things that you pick up. Now, how this manifests, for example, is let's say a parent gets sick. Someone in the family, maybe the oldest child, is going to start to adopt the role of caregiver now. And it's unspoken. This role wasn't told to them, but they're going to do it because they're reacting to the family dynamics as they change. And patterns will develop as each family member interacts with one another. So you're going to know who you can talk to, how to talk to certain people. You know, with mom, you're going to be more careful about your words. With dad, you're going to be more formal, whatever it is, right? So these patterns are going to start to develop. And as children grow older, the patterns of interactions might change, which affects the system. So as your kid gets older, they're going to want to not be that role of comic. They're probably not going to want to stay home as much. Or not set the table, or whatever. And that can cause dysfunctions in the system because now it's thrown off. Now, if you think about what I mean by that, if you think about a thermostat, right? You've got your heat setting and your cold setting, right? And if it gets too cold, the heat's going to turn on. If it gets too hot, the AC's going to turn on, right? It wants to keep a certain level of consistency, right? That's the case in families, too. There's a certain level of consistency that we want to keep within it. And when something gets thrown out of order, something else is going to happen to bring it back into order. So I'll demonstrate that in a little bit. So a lot of the dysfunction also comes from our individual families of origin. So from our parents. How we parent is going to be affected by the way that our parents parented us. Whether it's the same or different because you don't like the way that your parents did it, right? And we bring a lot of baggage from our family of origin into our current families. So how did your parents raise you? That's something that you should all reflect on. How did your parents raise you? And what was your parental relationship like? Because that's going to change the way that you might view your relationship with your kid or interact with your children. So how dysfunction occurs. This is really small. I'm really sorry about that. So the first bubble says stress in the system from one or more members. And then it says anxiety escalates in the family. And then the last one says one or more members get overwhelmed, isolated, or out of control. So that last one there, one or more members get overwhelmed or isolated or out of control. These are people who usually accommodate the most in the family. They are most likely the ones to try and reduce the tension, that kind of stuff. So for example, a person who might take the most responsibility in the family, and it can cause them to have unrealistic expectations of themselves. They might take too much control, they might get anxious, and usually this is the person who is dysfunctional in the family. So whether it's the alcoholic, the depressed, the delinquent, it's usually that person. But the person who has a problem isn't necessarily the problem. Oftentimes it's a symptom of the system. So I'll demonstrate that now. So the first bubble says, Dad is increasingly stressed at work and stays late. So now, normally Dad comes home at 6 o'clock. Now he can't come home at 6 o'clock. Your family dynamics has to change to accommodate that. So what happens is everyone at home also becomes more stressed. Why does that happen? Well, now Mom has to pick up the kids from both piano and hockey, and she's got to make dinner, and she's going to have to bathe the kids, because Dad doesn't come home until 9 o'clock, right? So Mom's going to be stressed out. The kids are going to be stressed out because Mom's stressed out because Mom's like, get your stuff together. And the kid's going to be like, what the heck is her problem, right? Right? So Mom's all of a sudden, she's stressed out and she's talking to the kids in a more stressed out way or criticizing them. It's displaced stress, right? And then what happens is the child can start manifesting the delinquent behavior now, because the child is like, now, okay, Mom's getting out of hand. She's always yelling at me now, and she's always criticizing the things I'm doing. She's always telling me I'm too slow. And that can cause a child to start to feel insecure, right? Feel insecure about their relationship with their mom, with the way that they are, maybe. They're going to start to internalize, oh, I'm lazy. Mom's always telling me I'm too lazy, right? And then the child might go to Dad and be like, Dad, Mom's ridiculous, and I don't want to talk to her. And Dad's going to be like, this is so stressed out, stressful. I'm going to stay even later at work because I don't want to come home to this now. Okay. So it's a system. It's not linear. It doesn't happen in a straight line. Everything feeds into each other. Everybody feeds into each other. So it's important to understand how your system is affecting your child. Is there anything wrong with your marriage, for example? If there's parental if your parents have problems and they're fighting all the time, what can that do to your child and the relationship there? Because one thing that a lot of people do is they do something called triangulation, and they talk to their kid, oh, your dad is always blah, 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 blah. And then Dad's like, your mom's so crazy, right? What can that do to your relationship with your child at that point? That's really unhealthy, right? So what's going on in your system? Did something change in the system to make that behaviors that you see in your kids, or to cause a disruption in your relationship with your kids? That's important to recognize. So how does your family dynamics affect your child? These are questions that I want you guys to ask yourself. Is the stress in the relationship due to the system rather than my child? So perhaps there is stress in your relationship with your kid. Ask yourself, is it just between me and my kid? Is it just that? Or is there something more going on? Are they upset because of the way that I treat my brother? Right. So, for example, I have a friend, and his relationship with his mom is very, very rocky. He's the one that absorbs all these behaviors. He's a dysfunctional child right now, right? He's the one that's very depressed and that kind of stuff. And it's not between him and his mom, actually. The issue is between mom and the older brother. The mom and the older brother have a lot of resentment against each other due to some hurt that happened a long time ago. And because they're always fighting, my friend's always trying to get in the middle to help them out, to change that. And now that's causing a rocky relationship with my friend and his mom. So do you see how like that can manifest itself if there's stress in the system rather than the relationship? So how is my relationship with my spouse affecting my relationship with my child? So I talked about this idea of triangulation. Because your relationship with your spouse is what your child sees. That's what they know a relationship to be. So if it's rocky and you guys are always yelling at each other, that's their norm. That's what they think a relationship's going to look like. Right? So if you're swearing at your spouse, you better expect that your child one day might swear back at you. Because these are behaviors they're going to mirror. These are interactions they're going to mirror. And so, for example, the relationships that are going to be really important include the daughter and father relationship. How the father treats the mother is going to be integral to how the daughter perceives intimate relationships later on. And how the father treats the daughter is going to be important to show her how she should be treated or can be treated as a person, as a woman, as a spouse later on, right? So that's important. But also the relationship between mother and son will be very important because the mother is the first woman that your son is going to interact with, right? And so if your relationship with your son is no good as a mother, there's a likely chance that his relationship with his spouse later on might not be good because he's used to interacting with women this way, right? What kind of rules and roles does my family have and how do they affect my child? Have you scapegoated one of your child as the bad child? Have you assigned the role of smart child to one of the children? What kind of pressure does that put on your child? Do I have expectations about my kids and how they're going to act? And lastly, am I bringing things in from my family of origin that were dysfunctional? The way that you react to your parents, the way that your parents interacted with you, does that affect your family? Lastly, I'm going to talk about cultural issues. What are some of the cultural issues that you have experienced that cause problems in your child's relationship? Does anybody have anything that they want to point out in your family, perhaps? For me, communication barrier was one of them. I can speak Chinese, but not well. Are there any cultural issues you guys have experienced? Okay, so like the language barrier thing, right? Yeah. Okay, so he has a very negative feeling towards your culture, your country. Yeah. I'm going to point some things out. So one of the things that we've noticed is an authoritarian parenting style. So this is based on research. So I'm not just observing this from my family. Yeah. This is based on research. We found that Chinese parenting often is very authoritarian. What that means is there's a low support and high control. So what do I mean by support? Support isn't like I work hard and I give you money and I provide for your education. That's not the support I'm talking about. I'm talking about emotional support. Are you there for your child when they're having a hard time? Are you warm to them? And do you speak kindly to them? Do you encourage them and praise them? And then also this high control thing. A lot of Asian parents like to really, really control what their kids do, right? What are your grades? Always looking at report cards. Very, very strict on what options they might take in high school, electives, I guess you guys call it. Very strict, very tight monitoring, and lax warmth. Now, that's not true for all Chinese parents, right? I'm sure you guys might have very different experiences, but this is what I found in research. And a lot of this is influenced by Confucian philosophy. So you might not even realize it, but this comes from like a very old philosophical thinking. So this high respect and devotion to parents, the word house, right? That's a very Confucian ideal. Emotional constraint because of this idea of you don't want to lose faith. There needs to be social cohesion, words. So if I cry too much, I'm going to disrupt everybody else. So that's not good for, you know, the everybody else. So I shouldn't cry. And high value on education. So that's also very, very Confucian. What occurs from this is there's very high expectations for our child. And there's a high regard for this idea of social cohesion. And so we end up having this shame-based culture. So what that means is we use shame to control our children. So we say, like, oh, don't do this because of, oh, what would other people think of you? Right? And it can cause a lot of problems in a child because they're always afraid of what other people will think, what other people will think. So this isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, all these things are not necessarily bad. Okay, Confucian ideals are good, right? You should respect your parents. We should value education. But the problem is, how high are you placing these values? So let's navigate some of these cultural barriers. So I want you to ask yourself, what is more important? Maintaining your culture or having a good relationship with your child? Because I think sometimes we place our cultural values above our relationships with our children, and we fight with our children over these little issues of culture and differences in culture. You know, in my culture, we don't talk to people like this. Well, we're not in your culture now. And I'm not saying that, I mean, that's, I'm saying this from a child's point of view. It's like, well, I live in Canada, I'm not in China, right? But for you as a parent of a second generation child, it might be hard because this is what you grew up with, this is what you know, and now you come here and your children are throwing all of that out the window, right? Understand the cultural differences and don't value or judge one culture over the other. So we need to understand what our child's culture is like. Why not ask them, hey, what are kids into these days? What is it like when you go over to Johnny's house? Right? Why do you like that kind of music? Right? But don't say, oh, it's so much better like in China. It's so much better to have, you know, X, Y, and Z values. I think one of the things my mom was always saying, talking to me about was like, she's like, oh, white people are so weird. They throw their mothers into nursing homes, right? And that demonstrated to me, oh, okay, I should not throw my parents into a nursing home when I get older, right? But like, I mean, this is one example of comparison that we do often with our cultures, and often we're judging one culture over another. But remember that your children are growing up in a very different culture than you. And it doesn't necessarily mean that their culture is bad, but perhaps it's trying to understand the differences and navigating those differences together, discussing, hey, what do you think is better? Why do you think it's better? Allow children to also understand that cultural differences and reasoning behind your cultural values. So don't just say, in my culture, we do this, so you're going to do this. But letting them know, hey, when I grew up, this is what it was like, you know, because da-da-da-da-da, right? So that they can understand where you're coming from, and they can empathize with you. And this allows them the chance to empathize with you, so that they can build that relationship with you, too. And accept their Canadian identity without diminishing your own cultural identity. So a lot of kids are going to grow up saying, I'm Canadian, I'm not Chinese, I'm Canadian. Right? Allow that, because they are Canadian. They're growing up in a Canadian culture. I know it's sad for some of us as who really desire and hold on to that Chinese culture. But they are Canadian, and that's the identity that they have chosen for themselves. So you should accept that. At the same time, don't let that downplay who you are, that you are Chinese, that your values are this way. And it's okay. It's both okay. We're allowed to have that difference. And don't reinforce harmful cultural elements, such as the shame-based culture. And I bring up this shame-based culture because this has been so, so harmful to a lot of second-generation children. And it's not Christ-centered. And it's not... God never, ever wants us to sit in our shame and just be ashamed. You know, He wants us to be redeemed and pulled out of that shame to live as full human beings, right? But when we put that on our child and we're like, hey, you should be ashamed of yourself for whatever it is that they did, and constantly make them feel guilty that they're not good enough, that nobody will like them because of these things, it can bring down their self-esteem. It can make them feel less than. And I remember one example of that was, it's not from my parents, but my parents' boss, who was very, very traditionally Chinese. And she said to me, you know, men don't like strong women. You'll never get married. And I'm like, I am so glad these are not my parents and they didn't say that to me. Right? But imagine what that does to their own child. They have a girl. Right? That her value is in marriage and marrying a man. Right? So be very careful about what kind of values you're displaying to your kids. Are they going to harm them? And some of the values in our cultures are not always good. And we have to evaluate those things. And in terms of relating to your child and communicating these things to your child, it's about working together to come to this conclusion, not enforcing it, not saying this is good, this is bad, but coming together and discussing with your kids. Because at the end of the day, if it's their idea, it will be an idea that stays with them. And it'll be stronger, a stronger value than if you were to try and impart it onto them.